You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network. On the West Coast, that means it's 11:07 on the East Coast. So, all you fat people that are can't wait to get to lunch, yeah, 53 more minutes and you're there. Joining me, retired Marine Major, and we all know Majors are the backbone of the Marine Corps, Carl Forsling. And Carl, first of all, good morning. Welcome to All Marine Radio.
Good morning. Thanks for having me on. I appreciate it.
No, it's taken us a while to get this together, so. So, when you emailed and said, "Hey, man, I can do it this week. Let's go." I was all about it. And I mean, oddly enough, strange coincidence, you are you're an Osprey pilot. And I hope you don't mind if we talk Ospreys a little bit, because they were in the news over the weekend. And one of the things I'd like to do, on All Marine Radio is explain things, not speculate, but explain things, and even smaller world. My son's part of the 31st MEU. He's part of the Hilo company of 3rd Battalion, 5th Marines. And so, you know, they obviously had an accident, a mishap over the weekend. And so I want to just, I wondered if you would mind just explaining what a pilot would be doing. In two different scenarios, one if it's a controlled entry into the water, and two if it's an uncontrolled entry into the water. If you wouldn't mind, just what goes on in the cockpit as they're doing their thing. So and then we'll talk about your article, Investing in Marines. So if you don't mind doing that, you can stay on the program. How's that sound?
Or my keep.
Exactly.
Well,
okay, if you're okay with that, we have to find out about you a little bit first. So born and raised where?
Ames, Iowa.
Ames, Iowa. You know, you and I were talking before you came on. A buddy of mine's gonna drive through Iowa here pretty quick, and he tells me that there's no trees in Iowa. Like, who sent the memo out to cut down all the trees in Iowa? Do you want to as a proud? Would you be called an Iowan?
Yeah, I think that's the right term for natives, yeah.
Okay, as a proud Iowan, what happened to all the trees?
Well, I think some farmers got together and chopped them down over the course of a few years back in like the 1700s or 1800s. Yeah. I mean, it's just, the nice thing about Iowa is you can see one side all the way from the other and you're just driving a straight line and not hit anything, so.
There you go. All right. All right. Hey, there you have it. Easy answer to an easy question. Where do you go to college?
University of Pennsylvania, in Philadelphia.
Wow. So you go to Penn, and then how does the Marine Corps get on your radar?
Well, they paid for college, so that was kind of their thing. I did the Navy Marine Austin, Navy ROTC.
Okay.
And originally I had intended to do the classic Marine thing and go into infantry like every person who joins initially starts wanting, and then, about halfway through ROTC, that, they ask you want to take the aviation aptitude exam and all that, and it turned out real well, and they offered me the opportunity for an aviation guarantee, and it sounded like a pretty good deal, and it kind of started me down this road.
So, you cheesed out like the rest of them relative to being a grunt? Come on, man.
What's yeah, pretty much. You know, there's a lot of folks that way, yeah.
Okay, so, and then, so you go to, what'd you major in at Penn?
Management. Technically, my major is economics, but if you're in the business school, you think of it as your concentration. In my case, is entrepreneurial management.
Okay, so major's economics, entrepreneurial. So, wow, all right. I was an economics major, and I think we both know only cerebral people go down that road. Okay, there's a lot of math involved. There's a lot of modeling and moving things. So the stupid among us, they don't stay in that class very long. A lot of drops. So they come in, for one reason. Oh, money and banking. That sounds like interesting. Yeah, man, it's not. It's a lot of math and, like, what? Yeah, you should drop this. You should drop this class. Hey, thanks. And then you
I went to business school thinking I wanted to be, you know, like Gordon Gekko on Wall Street. And I realized how much math was involved, and I sort of scaled that dream back a little bit.
Attaboy. Attaboy. So now you go down to Pensacola after you go through OCS in the basic school, and how do you get into the Osprey pipeline?
Well, it was kind of those long roads. I went through flight school. I talked to helicopters. That's what I wanted. And then I ended up being assigned CH-46s on the East Coast. And did a tour of those about 4 years, flying off of in Jacksonville, North Carolina, in the Marine Corps Station New River. And then I decided to go to Pensacola for an instructor tour. And while I was there, the Osprey happened to sit down. And as they brought it back into service and were in the return to flight process, they started to give presentations around the major air bases and what have you. And really caught my attention with, you know, the good things they were doing, and it looked like an amazing aircraft, a lot more interesting. And especially, I was thinking about getting out of the Marine Corps at that time, and I realized the Marine Corps and the Air Force was the only place to do the sliding thing. And so I applied to the board and ended up being selected as one of the first group of people going through after the program stood back up. This is about 2004.
Okay. What about, I have to tell you, the CH-46, my favorite helicopter of all time.
Well, I mean, it's a good aircraft. I mean, it's an old one. I mean, it was then, even, and it definitely would be if it was still around now. But, for its day, it was a great plane.
Well, let me tell you, we could have used it in Afghanistan. I mean, it's nimble. You can shut it down in a firm base, and there's a lot of them. And so we could have used it. I don't want to be too critical of the Osprey this early in the show. We'll get to that part, but. So how many different, so how long did you fly the Osprey?
Well, I guess, from 2004 until when I got out in 2015, so just over 10 years.
Okay. And, how many combat deployments with that?
With the Osprey, didn't do any combat deployments with the Osprey, unless you consider burying them in Afghanistan, combat deployment. I did a Mew, with the Osprey, and then, towards a police advisor to Afghanistan, but that was not in the Osprey, but
right
on the ground.
Right. Give me a lesson learned from your combat experience. A single lesson. I'm going to put a book together entitled, I have two sons that are in the Marine Corps, one a captain at the basic school, the other one out on the 31st MU. But in my head, I have this book, Things I'd Like My Sons to Know Before They Go to War. And have guys that I know, that are smart guys, good guys, tough guys, write a single chapter devoted to a single lesson. If I gave you a chapter, what would you write about?
I guess the still found one thing that's pretty hard, but it's kind of don't expect it to be like you thought it would be. And that's, true in a lot of ways. The thing you think you're going to be most, worried about is never the one that actually ends up being that. I went to Afghanistan the 46 in 2001, right after 9/11, and you think it's going to be, some sort of high intensity conflict or whatever you want to call it. And, it turns out to be the biggest enemy out there is the environment. And that's what we're far more concerned and damage far more aircraft than anything that the enemy at the time could do, as an example.
Wow. The my guest is Carl Forsling, Major United States Marine Corps, retired here recently, and written an article called Investing in Marines that we'll get to here in a second. Talk to me about emergency procedures in the Osprey. If you deployed with a Mu, a lot of ship to shore movement, is what it does for a living. So you're over the water a fair amount. When you begin to lose power and you can't make it back to the ship, what do you do? What are you doing in the cockpit, in terms of, trying to, I guess, water land that thing. We were talking about this earlier this week. Back in the day, when men were men, and Marines were aboard ships guarding nuclear weapons, I was the executive officer of the Marine Detachment on the USS Ranger. So we're at sea, I'm working, all of a sudden somebody says, holy shit, look at the TV. And here's a 46 in the water driving. And they used to do, guys used to love to go watch them do vert rep. It was almost
right.
It was almost like a ballet with these sling load things, and they had this pattern they do. Very cool to watch. And but he loses power between the two ships, can't get to either one of them, sets it down in the water, drives it as, I guess, the crew chief hops out, the co-pilot hops out. He keeps driving it through the water, and then it looks like he shuts it down and then rotates it to one side so he can jump out the other. It was incredible to watch.
Right.
Since you're a 46 guy, is that the way you draw that thing up? And have you seen that video?
I've not seen that video.
I'll
it's
send
funny
it to
you mention that water landing technique actually used to be a thing in the 40s. In the days before I was there, the Navy especially would go to freshwater areas and practice dipping a thing in the water.
No kidding?
Drive around a little bit.
Holy smokes. Wow.
Or the old guys will tell you. But that was the syllabus by the time I was in there. You can do that's not necessarily the technique they teach to, but you do want to obviously get the crew out of the aircraft before you shut down, because in a helicopter it's top heavy. So once the rotor stops spinning, it's going to have a tendency to flip over.
Right.
So you can steer the events so that you get the crew out, and then you hopefully can control that, rather than letting it control you. It's going to increase your chances of getting out alive.
Okay, so talk to me about the Osprey. Is the Osprey so different? Is that the procedure in a controlled entry into the water? Is it pretty much the same thing?
The situation is going to be there's enough variables in the situation. I'll really think of
right.
You cover them all adequately. I would say that you're a lot less likely to find yourself in a event like that for a few different reasons. First of all, the aircraft, it likes to be in an airplane a lot better. So if you find yourself, for example, a single engine scenario, you're much better able to transition that thing to a fixed wing, mode. And then you're going to have the range to have a lot more options as far as time, whether you want to drive that to a controlled ditch or whether, looking at your fuel, your power available, whether there's a field on land you'd be able to divert to. And that'd be the preferred mode, use that sort of runway and land as an airplane, vice as a helicopter to the water. And that, in a helicopter, your range sort of limits you to a very narrow sort of options. Whereas a tilt rotor, assuming the nature of the emergency is such a half time, that it gives you that breathing room to think about it, and that range to give you a lot more options than the ship or the water. That's your options as a helicopter.
Right.
And a tilt rotor, a lot of times you can have a lot more things going on.
Okay, so explain, if you're in the helo mode of the Osprey and you lose an engine, you say the aircraft likes to be in airplane mode more than it likes to be in helicopter mode. If you do have to do a controlled entry into the water, what are you doing in the cockpit?
It's going to be very much time altitude dependent.
Okay.
If you're dealing with something happening at low altitude and you're heavy enough that there's not sufficient power and you're just going to go into the water, and you'll be concentrating on your immediate actions required to safely get the crew out and egress yourself.
So as a pilot, how do you trying to get the crew out? And let me ask you a quick question. 23 of 26, get out. I don't care when an aircraft goes in the water. That's an incredible number. Yes.
Yes, I don't know.
Right.
I can't really comment on this particular one. I don't know the specifics, and I wouldn't feel comfortable.
Right.
Until that full investigation comes out. But
right.
Yes, impressive testament to both the training of the individuals and to the aircraft that enough people were able to get out, or that many, I should say.
Right. Okay. So as you're dealing with this, obviously you're not going to have a whole lot of time to deal with it. What are you doing as a pilot?
Again, not speaking to this particular scenario,
right.
But in general.
Just in general.
Well, again, if it's a time limit scenario, ideally I'm going to try and get to a situation where I have, you know, my power to wait is working for me. So if possible, I'm going to try and get to that airplane mode. I'm going to try, and if I have time, to lower my weight by getting rid of fuel, because you do have a fuel dump capability.
Okay.
And assuming that I get control of the aircraft and have that, have enough lift, then I'm going to evaluate, you know, where I can go to and where I have available landing sites.
Okay. All right. So if that, okay. And as those, let me just kind of walk you down the road. As those options leave you over water, what are you left with? You don't have enough time to get it to airplane flight. You're ditching fuel, but as you're evaluating it, it looks like you're going to have to put it into the water, and then you decide, I'm going to have to put it in the water. What do you concentrate on when you do have to put it in the water?
I mean, really, the last situation, we're getting down a sort of a specific road. I'm not really sure.
Well, no, this could be any, I don't know what happened there, and I wouldn't speculate what happened there. I'm just curious about what goes on in the cockpit when you do make a decision that this thing, that I'm going to have to put this down to the water. What do you focus on in that aircraft?
I mean, like, you know, we have a mantra in aviation. It's got aviate, navigate, communicate. So you know, your first job is to make sure the aircraft is being handled safe.
Right.
And obviously, depending on how severe the emergency is, your options may be either wide or narrow. And if it's bad enough, you're going into, you know, you try and steer the aircraft, land to a level attitude at a low speed as you can, and to ensure as best a place as you can, trying to ensure that the occupants are able to have time to get out once you're in there.
Right.
And that's the aviate and navigate part. And then communicate, you're trying to get the crew and with the assistance of your team, who hopefully are well enough trained to, you know, have some initiative on their own, make sure the passengers and the crew are ready for that emergency landing, you know, wherever the case might be.
I'm asking an opinion question here. I'll read you the email, and then we'll take a break, and then we'll come back and talk about investing in Marines. Hey Mac, I'm curious. There was a pretty interesting discussion yesterday relative to value of helo dunker training. I'm just curious about what Carl thinks. Does he think we do enough of it? Because there was a sentiment expressed that the probability of going into the water is pretty low. The amount of time that it takes to get a lot of people through the helo dunker is probably not worth it, given the fact that you're not proficient if you only go through one time. I'm curious about Carl's thoughts about that.
I mean, at a higher level than I was in the Marine Corps,
right.
You know, people have to make the trade-offs between, you know, the risk and reward and how much it costs for every type of training. And so, you know, obviously they have to rack and stack, you know, this training, the cost of that versus some of the other probabilities. So the balancing act I won't comment on, but as far as the value of the training itself, if the emergency happens, I don't think you can really dispute that. So, ideally, always more is better. You know,
right.
You can't say that enough, but at the same point, some is better than none. And think that you can never have the first time in the water be that worst day of your life and you don't even know what you're doing, or the first day could be in a pool with a safety diver and you figure out what went wrong, you know, when you don't have life-threatening terror. So hopefully when this worst happens, you know, God willing it doesn't, but if it does, you've at least seen it. And you have some clue as to what to do. If you'll just succumb to the terror of that being the first time you've ever seen the scenario.
Got it. First of all, I want to just thank you for it's not easy to find people that will talk to explain again. The investigation will reveal what actually happened. But for instance, when Major Norton went into the ground up in 29 Palms at night on his gun run, I had friends, F-18 pilots, come on just to explain, what are you doing at night driving around up there? And, you know, what are you doing on a gun run? Explain that, because most of us have no idea what goes on. So first of all, I appreciate you, you know, explaining what goes on in an Osprey when you have things going wrong. So, one question before we take a break. The writing thing, you're obviously a bit of a writer. You write for Task and Purpose, which I think most Marines are familiar with. If not, Google it, Task and Purpose, and you'll see a great website relative to Marine Corps issues. And how did you when did you start writing? How did you get into that?
Well, I always had interest in, you know, if you got, you know, the nerd terms, professional military education, sort of self-taught and, you know, reading military, you know, books about military history, that sort of thing, and then taking the next step of, for writing about training and tactics and associated topics for things like the Marine Corps Gazette. So I've written articles about, various Marine Corps issues that, interested me off and on for a couple of years, and then, you know, the one for Proceedings, and then I think Lauren and Brian, two of the editors for Task and Purpose, saw those, and when they were working on getting Task and Purpose going, and they initially asked me to do a couple of feature articles, and then that sort of turned on to sort of an ongoing relationship that's gone on for a while.
The had you been a writer in college, or was the Marine Corps the first time you wrote?
I mean, I wrote for, you know, obviously classes and such before, but really, yeah, it's just the, you know, writing on military issues, which appealed to me, and then taking that to the next step of, you know, professional journals, and then to the blogosphere, and then, you know, the more popular mass market type things, like Task and Purpose. So it's just kind of a, you know, I wasn't a journal writer, you know, that sort of person before, just, again, just taking that interest to the, you know, one level to the next.
What was the first thing you wrote was?
I think the first thing I wrote for the Gazette was about, that's pretty boring. It's about how to streamline night vision goggle training. You know, I thought that we, you know, organize our flights around the, wrong parts of training based on the new technology. So I advocated changing the balance of how they flew those, changing the, getting rid of the highlight and low light classification. It's a pretty esoteric topic, but it's about aviation training, which is something I was very interested in at the time. And you know, that kind of led me to do a couple other pieces that people tended to like, at least in those you know, military circles.
The first thing I ever wrote was, "Why doesn't First Fire Team Rush?" which is still bouncing, which is still bouncing around the Marine Corps, and it had to do with using hand and arm signals and voice commands to try to move formations. And then going out to the 400 series range of 29 palms, and it doesn't work, and nobody's even shooting back.
Right.
Yeah. So I wrote that as a captain tactics instructor at the basic school. Major General Paul Kennedy was a first lieutenant. He and I wrote it, and it's a couple of years ago I came back from Afghanistan, and a friend of mine said, Dave Furness, who's a brigadier general now, and he says, "Come here, I got to show you something." I said, "What?" He goes, "I shouldn't do it, but I got to show you." So he takes me. We walk into the CP of 1-1, and up on the wall is that article. I was like, "That's right, man. That's quality journalism." But that was my my first attempt, and it had to do with controlling units by using base units and pushing base units and fire team leaders leading from the front by virtue of doing, and then having training your Marines to move off what you do. And that is the only way not to have attacks get stalled, not to be throwing rocks at people, which is routinely what had happened. But my first foray into journalism. One more quick email. This is an easy. Here's an easy one before we take a break. Hey Mac, I'm curious. Does Carl think we're going to go to war in North Korea? Hey, there's an easy one, Carl. You're a smart guy. You went to Penn. What do you think? Yes or no?
I'm going to say no, because the yes is too horrible to contemplate, and hopefully cooler heads are going to prevail on both ends of the spectrum here.
All right. You know what? I'm with Carl. All right. I say no. I don't think. I cry, and I have both fingers crossed right now, because having the sun out in the Pacific, yeah, we don't need to do that, okay? We don't need to do that. All right, my guest, retired. Marine Corps Major Carl Forsling. He's a former MV-22 Osprey pilot. He's also a writer. He's a graduate of Penn. And then where'd you go to graduate school?
I did part-time at Boston University. You know, they had an extension campus here while I was there, and so I took weekend classes and got
Master
of Science in Business a couple years back.
Oh, so you're, but, you know, I'm much relieved. I don't really like people from Boston, so that's one of the reasons I asked, like, hey, where are you from? And he said, Iowa.
Yeah,
I was like, yeah, good. He's not.
Yeah, Boston University degree, but I've never been to Boston, so.
You know what? That's the best kind of degree you can get from BU. All right, Carl, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to talk about investing in Marines, getting the best return. It's in the May issue of the May 2017 issue of the Marine Corps Gazette. More of All Marine Radio coming up next right here on the All Warrior Radio Network. Are you looking for the perfect gift for somebody who's in the military, for a first responder, for a hunter, for an outdoorsman, or somebody that just likes cool military stuff? I've got the perfect gift for you, the Battle Mug. Starts as 10 pounds of aluminum. It's milled, machined, anodized, adorned with Picatinny rails, and then stamped with the serial number, and it's ready for you to make your own. Anything that went on your rifle or pistol can go on your mug. Scope, laser, camera, light, put a lid on it, and you're ready for the field. If you're inside, add a flag and an emblem, and you're set. Perfect for any commemorative event. Farewell, promotion, retirement, birthday, anniversary, or get out of the doghouse. The Battle Mug is the perfect unique gift. Check out the entire line of product at battlemug.com. Enter the promo code Marine for 15% off. Battle Mug is a veteran-owned and operated company. The product is made entirely in the United States. Check it out. Battlemug.com.
All you veterans, listen up. This is Bob Nielsen, former Marine and founder of the 100 Entrepreneurs Project. Turner Construction is looking for veterans with real-world leadership experience to join their team of professionals.
Hold on, Nielsen. Are we talking about a job or a career?
Matt, Turner Construction is a great company with global opportunities for veteran leaders who are looking to start professional careers. I know. I returned to Turner after I got back from Vietnam and retired after 50 years. I had a great career traveling the world leading teams of Turner employees as we built incredible projects.
Are they looking for me to have construction experience, Bob?
Absolutely not. Turner is looking for leaders who have led under pressure. We want leadership. So if you're led in Iraq or Afghanistan or any other contingency, Turner Construction is actively looking for you.
So, a career with competitive pay, good benefits, and a company seeking veteran leaders. That's what we're talking about.
Bingo. We're on the right road when a grunt can understand it. Good job, Matt.
I appreciate that there, Nielsen. How do I get the ball rolling? What do I do?
Just email your resume to jobs@allmarineradio.com, and I will personally contact you and we'll begin the process.
I love it. Turner Construction is looking for veteran leaders who are looking for careers to join their veteran-friendly team. Email Bob Nielsen at jobs@allmarineradio.com. Let's do it.
I'm an individual member. I joined the Global South Foundation because I believe in what it can do, and I also wanted to stay tied to the community that I was part of.
The benefits for individual members of the Global South Foundation are two things. One is networking, keeping in touch with the community, developing new relationships at any stage of your career. And secondly, it helps people stay abreast and up to date on the latest issues that the South community should be aware of.
The Global Soft Foundation is a great partner of All Marine Radio. Find out more about them at globalsoftfoundation.org/Marines.
America's injured and critically ill service members face incredible challenges every day of their lives. Since 2004, the Semper Fi Fund has helped thousands of service members and their families with both immediate and long-term needs. Join the Semper Fi Fund in supporting American heroes. They've given so much. Now it's our turn. Learn how your tax-deductible donation makes a real difference in their lives at SemperFiFund.org.
All I can say about MilitaryByOwner.com is, wow, I listed my house on your website for only 2 weeks in a tough rental market, and now my house is about to get rented. I will definitely recommend you guys to everyone in the military. Thank you.
Are you located near a military base? Advertise with Military by Owner for optimum exposure to the military community. Military by Owner has experience helping military families find, sell, or rent their home near a military base for the past 15 years. MilitaryByOwner.com, proven and dependable.
We all have the ability to touch the lives of those around us. Moms, dads, neighbors, teachers, friends. These are the people who are always there to listen when we need to talk. Though their actions may not always be monumental, they are always felt. To someone going through a difficult time, a text, A call or a visit can mean so much. Reach out to the veterans in your life today. Let them know they're not alone. One simple act can make all the difference. That's the power of one. If you're a veteran in crisis or know one who is, visit VeteransCrisisLine.net for free 24/7 confidential support. Or call 1-800-273-8255 and press 1.
You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network.
Could you whisper in my ear the things you want to feel? I'll give you anything to feel it coming.
8:37 on the West Coast. We continue on a Friday edition of All Marine Radio, right here on the All Warrior Radio Network. And joining me is retired Major Carl Forsling. And we're going to talk about his article, which is which won the 2016 Kaiser Family Irregular Warfare Essay Contest. So, first of all, congratulations on that. How about that?
Well, thanks. I appreciate it.
Irregular Warfare. Explain your interest in it. How did you come up with this article?
I've always been a Marine Corps Gazette fan, which just seems like a nerdy thing to be. But
No. Are you kidding me? Cool guys like me are. You're not. That's not nerdy. Be careful what you say, man. You know what? I don't think the Marine Corps Gazette gets the credit that it deserves for the intellectual development and the lights that go on in the Marine Corps among different individuals, because it truly is our professional journal. And and I love having writers come on and talk about issues from gender in the Marine Corps to tactical things, to aviation readiness issues, to things like this. And so it is the intellectual lifeblood of the Marine Corps. And cool guys like me do it. So you're all right, man. You're all right.
Thanks. Yeah, I just I saw this contest coming up, and I wasn't even in the Marines anymore, but still interested in the field. My experience, my reading, and I think, especially not being in the Marine Corps any longer, it sort of probably gives me a little bit of a different perspective, maybe a little bit, honestly, more objectivity, but more freedom to take a different thought process on it. So I looked at the problem and kind of took my take on the question for the contest.
Okay, so what before we talk about the article itself, what shaped your views relative to irregular warfare? Was it your experience on the ground in Afghanistan? What shaped the prism that you view irregular warfare with?
I think that my ground tour there was probably the biggest influence, at least in terms of personal experience.
Right.
As an aviator, you don't usually get, I'll fess up, you don't get that good of a view a lot of things in the Marine Corps. But, if I'd known the ground tour was going to be that interesting, I probably would have spent more of that along the way.
Should have been a grunt, bro.
Yeah.
First of all, tell us about your ground tour. You mentioned it. Where exactly were you?
We were in Phnom Penh in Helmand Province,
okay.
Which at the time was about the most southernmost American base in the country. This was 2012, 2013. It was sort of a weird situation. I just finished a maintenance officer tour, and it's one of those things where you're a major, and you have to go somewhere. And so I was kind of offered the choice between going to help write the ATO, the air tasking order for the theater, one of the people on that team, or go to the field and advise the Afghan Border Police Battalion. And the second one seemed a lot more interesting than the first. So I put my hand in the air and did 6 months of TBS refresh. And I went over there with a group of guys. It was a good time.
Now, Phnom Penh, explain to everybody geographically where that is. People that are familiar with Helmand, you have Sangin up to the north. You have the Marja area kind of in the central part of Helmand. And then to the south, explain where Penh is.
So you have the Helmand River goes down to the south, and then it bends over to the west area. A lot of times people in the area call it the Fishhook. And it's down in that vicinity, right where the river starts bending over to the west kind of sharply. And so you had Fob Payne and Fob Castle were the two decent-sized bases in that area, and they're both within about 10 miles or so of each other.
Okay, and the down there, the border, the city of the border with?
Down to, I'm not going to embarrass myself the exact distances, but you're not too far from Pakistan down to the south.
Okay, all right. So that shapes you. Talk to me, what was the biggest thing? You prepare yourself, but then you get on the ground in Afghanistan, and the culture's, foreign to us. The terrain certainly, again, for time, space is always a challenge. You guys are out there alone and unafraid. What was the biggest eye-opener for you during that tour?
A lot of people talk badly about Afghan forces, and I think and a lot of that is well deserved. We had better than average for an Afghan unit, and you got to realize got a grade on a scale that's relevant for them, not the scale that's relevant for the Marine Corps.
Right.
And I was overall impressed by, the resourcefulness. In the United States, Americans get frustrated. The smallest bit of they can't believe they don't have enough yellow highlighters. That's enough to torpedo something. and these guys are just improvising and making things work in the field, regardless of how little they have, they're still, as I put it in another article, your average Afghan is basically going to survival school from the time he's born to the time he's an adult. And that lends itself to a little bit more, ingenuity, not in the traditional American sense, but in that's what they do in terms of making things work.
It's, and honestly, it's astounding, we would medevac kids and who would have, like, fingers and, parts of their hand ripped off doing machining work for their dad on the farm at the age of, like, 7. They were, like full franchised employees. And so, the culture, what you see, and then they're rolling around in the winter in flip-flops, and it's like 35, 40 degrees. I would tell you, and I'd be curious your thoughts, it is one of the most intellectually stimulating experience to see a different culture, to see the political military events that are going on, and then to try to, in some way, shape, or form, steward it to a different, better place. It's intellectually riveting stuff. Which you don't hear people say very often, but I think if you talk to anybody who goes there, that pays attention and is involved in it, they would tell you that it is absolutely gripping stuff, and that it's very hard to divorce yourself from when you leave. Your thoughts on that intellectually? They're complex, not easy problem.
The cultural piece is different, from top to bottom. Taking another example, what you're saying is, see these kids who are probably between 6 and 8 years old, herding the family's entire herd of sheep and goats, and it's like, wait a minute, our kids don't even watch a school by themselves anymore, and this kid's got his entire family's livelihood in his hands. Some people get, there's the cultural differences, the subtle things and the big things, and I think a lot of Americans sort of get wrapped up in that, and just sort of think it's different, therefore it's inferior. And obviously there are problems there. I'm not going to try and make light of that. But you keep the open mind and you take the good parts and try and work on those and exploit those. And then you try and minimize the parts that aren't working for them. Because they do have some right things to build on. You just have to put things in their terms, not in yours.
Okay. So that shapes the article itself. The primary thesis of the article is what?
I'd say it's kind of almost three-pronged thing. Is that we get wrapped around the whether we're going to regear our forces for high-intensity conflict or low-intensity conflict. But the Marine Corps is that middleweight force, and because it is, we have an opportunity to shape ourselves for that middle ground, which is really where conflict's going to be. We have that intrinsic modularity with the MAGTAF, that allows us to, sort ourselves into bigger and smaller units. And in order to take advantage of that, a lot of times how to organize the force questions revolve around technology. Whereas I think more emphasis needs to be done on the human realm in terms of training and, doing things like allowing Marines to stay in their fleet operating units longer so that they, develop those SOPs, develop that unit cohesion, and that, enhances that natural ability to scale up and down. But we sort of undercut that by, moving Marines around too much, before they fully develop their skills, in their MOSs.
So how would you change it? I mean, because, for instance, I want to say that a lot of people are, they're in one spot for 3 years, and in those 3 years, they may be in three different jobs. In that, do you lengthen 3 years? Do you not rotate as often through jobs? And we find a way in the promotion system to account for the fact that, this guy might have been in this position and not this position, because it seems like a lot of it is promotion driven. Well, we got to get him here, then we got to get him here, then this guy's got to come in here. Your thoughts on that? What do we have to change?
I think that's a good summary of the problem, is that a lot of times we put the cart before the horse, and we think, okay, what do we have to do in order to get this guy promoted? And then we neglect to look at why do we need these criteria for him to be promoted. So we get the people they have to go to through this job because it's a key billet and so forth and so on, and they have to get to X number of key billets before the time they're up for staff non-commissioned officer, and then before they're up for, first sergeant or master sergeant, they have to get these key billets. And so they have to go, maybe 3 years at one job, if that, and they churn and they're masters of many things, but are they really the master role we need? And so we need to look at, the promotion scheduling and also our grade shaping. Is it so bad if you have, multiple sergeants in a squad, multiple staff NCOs in a platoon? Right now we're so wedded to a strict pyramid structure. Do we really need that? It's worked in the past because the structure in past wars, you keep the amount of expertise, wasn't necessarily as great as it is today. So
right.
If you're going to keep a guy in the same unit for more than 3 years, let's say 4, 5, 6, do you need to go to a more special operations type rank model where you have more senior people in a small unit? Because the conflicts of the future are going to more closely resemble that than they're going to resemble World War II, for example.
Do you think we're artificially welded to conflicts like, actually Vietnam? We're pretty much along the same lines in terms of configuration as we were in Korea in World War II. Are we still welded to that model, or do we have enough people that think outside the bun that can break that, and so that we can task organize as we need?
I mean, I think we are well. I think the fact that we haven't changed it, essentially in well over, 70 years, says we take it as a given that's the rank structure we have is necessary for units to maintain good order and discipline, because that's the way we've always done it.
Right.
Now, as everything becomes more knowledge based, can you even that person who today might be, a PFC or a Lance Corporal, that job is becoming more intellectually advanced than it was in the past. And every day it's more so. So is it fair to really, keep him in that job as a rifleman for a couple of years and he, gets shifted somewhere else, or he gets promoted out of that before he truly achieves all he can in terms of expertise there? I think we need to look at the time needed to become fully qualified, even in a field like the infantry.
Which, let me tell you, the Marine Corps likes to say every Marine a rifleman, right? Get a bunch of Marines that aren't infantrymen, and say, all right, we're gonna walk down this street in Ramadi. Let's go, boys and girls. And you're gonna see, oh, wait a minute, because it's not an easy MOS when you have to go play You Bet Your Life every day. The skill level, the intensity, and what you have to be able to do is not. But we have this upper out mentality in the Marine Corps. You know, do you think we ought to get rid of that as well? That, look, if you want to stay as a corporal and you're a good corporal, but we don't think you'll necessarily be a good sergeant, we're okay with that. Do we need to get rid of the upper out thing and be comfortable with guys guys and girls who are comfortable being, being whatever rank and are competent at it and make us a competent force?
I think that's definitely, yeah, it's beyond what I wrote in the paper. I've written about that subject in other areas. But I think that's definitely part of it. That we have this fear that, hey, if we let people not get promoted and stay in the same job, that they're going to become lazy and so forth. And that could be true, but the way you solve that is by divorcing retention from promotion.
Right.
You know, and you board and retain based on high standards. Then you stop being a good corporal or a good captain or whatever level that person decides to specialize at. And you still have the option of getting rid of them. You don't let them become static, but you don't necessarily say that you have to be promoted, because you could be the, you know, say, best fire team lead in the Marine Corps, but you'd be a horrible platoon sergeant.
Right.
And why do we want to promote you until you fail, and then they'll get promoted, and then kick you out as a failed, you know, you failed selector, gunnery sergeant. Why don't we just keep him as that best fire team leader, because he was excelling there? Or same for pilots. Why do we make him try and be a squadron commander when he might not have the aptitude? But he's a great flight leader. You know, the examples are there for any MOS. You know, I accept that if you don't have a up route system, you have to replace it with some other means of attrition for people who don't perform. But we need to decouple those two concepts.
Great. You said there was kind of three pieces to the thesis. We got through one. What are the other two?
Well, the first one being that, you know, that war is going to be that middle hybrid war model.
Right.
You know, the second one that the Corps is uniquely suited to it. And then lastly, it's just that the people are the piece we're going to focus on. So, you know, going back to what we were saying, you were saying about the infantry having skills and other MOSs can't really walk that streets with the squad in an urban environment, you know. We need to increase that attrition, increase attrition in boot camp. You know, right now, very rare to attract people for aptitude. Usually it's physical injuries, frontal listening, things like that. But we need to have that freedom to, hey, you're not making the standard and you're gone. And the training needs to, every Marine needs to have that SOI level training. And the entry level qualification becomes your baseline. And then on top of that, the people who are infantry Marines and officers get something on top of that. But that infantry skill level needs to be the baseline, because in the future, every Marine has to be prepared to go out to a very austere environment. We may not have those FOBs. I write an article about how those FOBs are kind of a straitjacket for us.
Right.
That no matter what your MOS, you may have to be on the field and augment the infantry unit. You won't be able to be a passenger. You won't be just an automate. You're going to have to work in that squad, and you're not going to be able to just be there under their protection. You're going to have to do your job and be an infantry Marine. And that happens in some places, but it's kind of the exception, and we need to make it the standard.
How do we do that? Institutionally, what do we need to do? What drives that? Because, you know, the things that you're talking about, it's a huge system with a lot of pieces that drive manpower. It drives assignments, and you're talking about at least tweaking that. What are the major pieces that have to change?
Well, I think that goes to emphasizing, you know, people, not technology. Yeah, for a minimal, in terms of dollars, in terms of effort, you know, it puts literally billions of dollars into these major acquisitions programs, but we field them into a personnel system that's, you know, I don't deny that we do our best efforts, but it's still built around organizational structure. It's been the same since, you know, depending on how you define it, since the end of World War II.
Right.
So if we put the effort that we do in updating our equipment, at least some of that effort into modernizing our personnel system and then trying to figure out whether the incentives and mechanisms we have in there, from the promotion system to the training system, you know, both the MOS training and for initial accession training for enlisted officers, that same mental energy into, you know, determining whether this is still the same model we need now that we did 50 or 70 years ago. When most of these, our rank structures, our rank timelines, all those things are very similar to the way they were, you know, before the invention of computers. Just to, you know, put that in context.
Moderately disturbing, yes. That's my comment. I find interesting what we took away from World War II. And because if you look at, you can't find a picture of any two Marines wearing the same uniform in World War II, right?
Right.
But somehow or other, our legacy is like short hair, right? We follow orders. World War II, man, they did whatever they want. They, you know, they tricked out like tanks. They poured concrete on the sides of it. They welded stuff. They messed with the optics. They screwed with everything. I find this, what we came out of World War II and then the way that it was fought, it's like, how did we get there from here? Because what you're telling me was not what I see. You look at pictures of guys on, I don't care what, any island. Half of them are wearing khaki piss cutters. The other half are wearing their baseball cap. Some are wearing their steel pots. Some have thrown their helmet liner away and they wear their soft cover, baseball cap, if you will, underneath their helmet. None of them are wearing the same equipment in anything close to the same fashion. Yet the Marine Corps legacy is, and they wear their hair down to their ass. I mean, their Hollywood pictures where they have their cover off to the side. It's hilarious when you see the pictures they took. That was the Marine Corps. Yet the legacy of the Marine Corps is somehow not that. It's something extremely different institutionally, and we are tethered to it. Make no mistake about it. We are tethered to it. I mean, your thoughts, Carl?
I do think it's funny to bring that up because, you know, I've touched on this in the past too, is, you know, everyone obsesses, and rightfully so, that the legacy of those Marines is amazing, but it's funny that we harken back to some, you know, day in the past where the Marine Corps is perfect or this perfect military organization. It was never what we picture. You know, like you said, these guys had top covers, you know, great hair, Brill cream, amazing mustaches. And yet we, you know, get the high and tight comes out of that.
Right. We have this completely 180, but it's at least greater than 90 degree, you know, reality versus perception. It is vastly different. And, you know, but always, though, the horizontal theme in the Marine Corps always is what it is to be a Marine. And Marine Corps leadership. It's, but I agree with you. I think it's really interesting that we are culturally welded, to some of these organizations. I was told by General Boomer, I had a conversation with him in 19. I was leaving the basic school as an instructor and I had to go, Major John Allen at the time, wrote me up for an award. General Boomer read it and he said, send him over. I want to talk to him. So I had taught some decision making stuff at the infantry officer course, and so he's very interested in what I had to say. And he said, "What do we need to do?" And I said, "Well, you need to change recruit training." I said, "Because when you're in the fleet, you're a lieutenant. You're trying to get guys to think and be smart. Their role model is a drill instructor. He's never been a problem solver. He's been a disciplinarian. He's been an authority figure. You know, he knife edges people. That's all good. We need more than that." And he looked at me and said, "You know what it's like to try to change recruit training?"
Right.
He said, "You get letters from all over the world about it, about how this saved his life in Korea. This saved this guy's life on Saipan. This saved this guy's life on Hill 881 in Vietnam." And so he said, I said, "Well, you got to make the advertisement, though, because if you don't, what I need to do is I need to be able to draw on that advertisement and him go, 'Oh, yeah, my drill instructor did that. That's what I want to be.'" And so institutional change in the Marine Corps is not easy. And then the other interesting thing I found is that if you can go back and find guys like Pete Ellis, the Ellis Group, because the Marine Corps has always been an innovative place.
Right.
If you can sell people that we're actually returning to our roots instead of unscrewing ourselves, you got a much better chance of modifying something, because nobody likes to be unscrewed and nobody likes to do something new. But we all like to return to our roots, especially in the Marine Corps. And so institutional change, very tricky. And the things you're talking about are embedded in the institution.
Oh, you're right. And as the, like we talked about, the things that we remember as being what made the Marine Corps back then are not the things that really did. You know, Pete Ellis, for all his genius, was, to put it mildly, a troubled Marine officer. I don't think he would have reached the, put out his work that he did back then if he was subject to a lot of the, you know, norms that we have today.
He would have been booted out of the Marine Corps in short order today.
Oh, yeah, he would be out of the captain for sure.
If he made captain. If he made captain.
If that, yeah.
You know, you're right.
And the Marines you're talking about, as far as, you know, the ones who didn't have uniform standards, you know, they were civilians who were briefly Marines to fight this conflict, who became Marines, I should say. And they took that, you know, their civilian experience from dozens of different fields in civilian life and were forced to employ it in the military context, and you got these innovations from that. And the discipline we teach in boot camp is something that needs to be there, but are there elements that we need to add to it or change in order to make it better suited for the future? You know, is it the same model we've had for, you know, over half a century? You know, probably needs a few tweaks here and there. Of course, every generation thinks the one before theirs was better. You know, going on back to Tom Tavern, everyone thinks the Marine Corps has been going steadily downhill since 1775.
I'll tell you one of the things, something that's really interesting, Carl, and I kind of got, I don't know, it's probably close to a month or so ago, I was talking to one of the company commanders at Quezon, and he asked me if I knew, he said, are you familiar with My Lai? And I said, yes, I don't know the details. And then when I got off the phone, I thought, how do I not know more about that? So I started researching it, started watching videos, started reading about it, and I was blown away because what happened there was not what I thought happened there. I thought it was a unit that had been in country for an extreme long time, had been chewed up. Neither one of those premises were true. So then it got my intellectual curiosity, like, well, what happened? How did somebody new to the country do something like that? And then after I kind of did a series of shows on it about My Lai, because I'm not alone in not knowing the details, it kind of got me to thinking about the Commandant's whole keep your honor clean thing.
Right.
Right? And so I don't think we teach that right. You don't keep your honor clean for the institution. You keep it clean for you because you've got to live with that. As Maximus says, what we do in life echoes in eternity. If you look at the interviews of the My Lai guys 20 years later, their lives were ruined by that event. And they're, the interviews are so powerful as they talk about, how the events of that day have changed their entire life. One guy had his 3-year-old son get killed in spillover fire from a gang incident, and the little boy was in his grandmother's front yard. And he said, I went out and to pick my son up, and he was dying, and all I could see was a little Vietnamese kid that I had killed, and I knew God had taken his revenge on me. And you hear these things and suicide attempts because of not being able to live with that which they can never forget. And then ICE brought on guys like, I don't know, are you familiar with Carl Marlanis, the author of Matterhorn and What It's Like to Go to War?
I haven't read those books, but I've
okay, right. Right. He's a Navy Cross, a recipient, as a first lieutenant in Vietnam. And then other Marines and officers to talk about mutilation, scalping ears, rape, what else? Killing civilians. And every one of them said the same thing. Vietnam wasn't a whole lot different. It had its own unique personality, but that was about leadership. And every conflict has them. Right? You had, I'm sure, had leadership challenges and the way people looked at the civilian population that you were working with. And a guy named Ken Rogers, who did a documentary about Quezon, tells a story. At the end of Quezon, they go out on patrol. They see there's a stack of bodies decomposed. As they're walking by, one of the Marines grabs a femur out of the pile and puts it in his war belt, and they keep walking. And he said within, you know, within 5 minutes, one of the squad leaders walked up to him and said, get rid of that shit right now. And he said, and we never had another incident. He said, and, you know, so people that, so to me, it's interesting that there's certain timeless parts of leadership and the institution that you need to embrace. There's other parts that I think your argument embraces in terms of there ought to be things that are scalable that we're able to tweak so that we do invest in the Marines in the appropriate way. But it's hard because the Marine Corps is so steeped in its own history and tradition.
Right, yeah, and some would say mythology, but our values didn't change. But the tactics and the way they work in the real world, yeah, it has to, or else we'll fall behind. Yeah, it's in this world. It's, you know, again, it's a cliche, but it's knowledge based. And if we can't adapt to it and make the knowledge the center of gravity, vice whatever weapon system it is, then we're not doing as well as we could. We're investing in the wrong things. It's the knowledge in that Marine's head is the most important weapon he has. You know, but we don't always carry through with our words or our actions what we say. You know, as an example, you know, do we put it, you know, there's always that conflict. Do we educate Marines or do we train Marines? There's a place for both, but a lot of times you don't do enough education, you know, teaching guys how to think and not just what to do. You know, college programs to enlist Marines are either phrased in terms of just a recruitment incentives, like, hey, join the Marine Corps and get the GI Bill, or it's, you know, use your TA so you can get a degree before you leave the Marine Corps and so you get a better job. But we never think about, hey, is there a way we could, you know, teach these Marines college classes that relate to their jobs, make it free or incentivize them to do so? You know, whether it's language skills, whether it's medical skills, things like that to make them, you know, better thinkers, not just doing the battle skills type things that we do as part of their jobs.
All right, I've got an email for you, and I'll let you go. My guest this morning, very graciously, retired Marine Major Carl Forsling. He's a former CH-46 pilot and an Osprey pilot. Email, Mac, you were bad-mouthing the Osprey yesterday in terms of being agile on the battlefield and lamented for the return of the CH-46 during your time in Afghanistan. I'd be curious to hear Carl's comments. Let me give you my criticism. The Osprey is not the most nimble aircraft in and out of LZs when you need to be nimble. The war we fought in Afghanistan, at least in 2010-11, when I was in and around Marja, we very desperately could have used, and we would not have hesitated to shut down 46s in a firm base, something that could have gone out and then put in a QRF squad behind somebody that was shooting in order to kill or capture them and not have to, you know, do that over and over and over again. Yet we don't have a nimble platform, medium lift nimble platform in the Marine Corps anymore. At least that's my opinion. What say you, pilot man?
I would say, a couple things on there. One, I think the, you know, nimbleness in and out of the LC, it depends on how you define that. And as a 46 pilot, I think we sort of, as well, mythologize and, say things that weren't necessarily always true. That aircraft is extremely power limited.
Right.
And growing old, and it's, if you actually look at the, EM diagrams of the 46, it's not as maneuverable as people think it was. And the V-22 is more nimble, you know, in terms of both low and especially high speed maneuverability, than the 46.
No, I'm not talking about high. I'm not talking about high speed. I'm talking about what we lacked was being able to, maybe in a moderate, I won't say a hot LZ, but being able to move quickly in and out of LZs, and the Osprey simply is so slow in and out that it.
I wouldn't agree with that. I mean, as having flown both traditional helicopters and V-22s, I'll tell you that the short final, once the Osprey is in VTOL mode, or obviously a helicopter is already in VTOL mode 100% of the time.
Right.
The airspeed and altitude checkpoints on short final are exactly the same. So any difference in time perception in that,
is us?
Is a visual illusion of some type for most cases. When it's not, just use, for example, when I was in Afghanistan in 46, it was going from the East Coast here to flying in Afghanistan, the dust there was crazy.
Right.
But you do a bright out landing in a traditional helicopter, it's, you level the attitude and try and adjust the power and you time your landing with the rad out and using the attitude indicator, try and make it level, landing with zero speed, just as the wheels touch down. And I'll tell you what, people in our unit screwed it up a lot and we left a lot of bent wheels and broken aircraft in that country. And the Osprey, you have so much automation and some excess power that you can make sure that you get the LZ and minimize number of wave offs. If you're in that dusty environment and some of those automation occasionally may take a couple extra seconds, but I tell you what, I'd rather be on the ground the first time through than having to go, wave off and come around again, whether it's that, soft hit or a hard hit environment. I don't want to go to Afghanistan in the 46 ever again, but I do it in an Osprey in a heartbeat as far as the landing environment in particular. I feel much more confident landing in an aircraft.
All right, there you have it. There's the rebuttal. Carl, first of all, thoroughly enjoyed having you on. I hope you don't mind in the future when we're talking, whether it be leadership or issues in the Marine Corps, if I give you a call. You're not shy about opinions, and you've obviously written a bunch. So I hope you don't mind if I bug you in the future.
Yeah, that'd be great. Appreciate it.
No, first of all. Tell us about you write for Task and Purpose. How often is your stuff there?
Was generally around once a month nowadays. Was doing a weekly column, but sort of stepped that back and been doing some other things. But I try and keep regular appearances in that and occasionally some other writing opportunities when they come up.
Okay, so on Task and Purpose, if we go to the website, put in your name, is there a page devoted to your work? Will we find that?
You can. There's a search bar in there. To just type in Carl Forsling or some combination thereof. Eventually you get to a page that has all, several pages of my Task and Purpose articles going back about, I guess, almost 4 years now.
Wow. He's a, that makes you a legit writer. And you spell it with a C, C-A-R-L,
yes.
F-O-R-S-L-A-N-G. You can find him at Task and Purpose. You also mentioned blogging. Do you have your own, do you still have a blog? Do you do that or what?
I contribute to other sites here and there. Hushkit was, an aviation blog I contributed to just most recently. Don't do my own page. I do have a Tumblr where I keep all my old articles, but I'm not particularly don't have my own website. Haven't gone corporate just yet. maybe after I get a book out someday, I'll get my personal website.
All right. Well, whenever you publish something, shoot me a link, and I'd be happy to put it up on our site as well. My guest for the last hour or so has been, again, retired Marine Major Carl Forsling. He would rather fly in the MB-22 than the 46. So there you have it. All right, Carl, first of all, thanks for the visit. Congratulations on your first place in the Kaiser Family Irregular Warfare Essay Contest. It's in the May Gazette. It's a great article, obviously. I would encourage you to check it out. So hopefully not a stranger in the future to All Marine Radio. Thanks for the visit, Carl. Appreciate it.
No problem. Have a good day.
All right, bud. There you have it. Hey, Carl, and one more thing. Thanks for answering, thanks for explaining the MV-22 stuff. Our purpose never here is to speculate when these things happen, but to explain the complexity of those moments, the time space, how in this case and in other cases, how little time that aviators have to make decisions, what they're trying to do, what they're trying to balance, and I get all emails all the time saying, hey, I ran across this interview or I listened to this, and what an awesome radio show. We don't hear that stuff in that kind of detail very often, and thank you very much. So thank you very much for participating. In that, I appreciate it.
Oh, you're welcome. No problem.
All right. There you have it. Carl Forsling. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, the gunner joins us. Michael Musselman on a Friday edition of All Marine Radio right here on your home for it, the All Warrior Radio Network.
America's injured and critically ill service members face incredible challenges every day of their lives. Since 2004, the Semper Fi Fund has helped thousands of service members and their families with both immediate and long-term needs. Join the Semper Fi Fund in supporting American heroes. They've given so much. Now it's our turn. Learn how your tax-deductible donation makes a real difference in their lives at SemperFiFund.org.
All you veterans, listen up. This is Bob Nielsen, former Marine and founder of the 100 Entrepreneurs Project. Turner Construction is looking for veterans with real-world leadership experience to join their team of professionals.
Hold on, Nielsen. Are we talking about a job or a career?
Matt, Turner Construction is a great company with global opportunities for veteran leaders who are looking to start professional careers. I know. I returned to Turner after I got back from Vietnam and retired after 50 years. I had a great career traveling the world leading teams of Turner employees as we built incredible projects.
Are they looking for me to have construction experience, Bob?
Absolutely not. Turner is looking for leaders who have led under pressure. We want leadership. So if you're led in Iraq or Afghanistan or any other contingency, Turner Construction is actively looking for you.
So, a career with competitive pay, good benefits, and a company seeking veteran leaders. That's what we're talking about.
Bingo. We're on the right road when a grunt can understand it. Good job, Mac.
I appreciate that there, Nielsen. How do I get the ball rolling? What do I do?
Just email your resume to jobs at allmarineradio.com. And I will personally contact you and we'll begin the process.
I love it. Turner Construction is looking for veteran leaders who are looking for careers to join their veteran-friendly team. Email Bob Nielsen at jobs@allmarineradio.com. Let's do it. Are you looking for the perfect gift for somebody who's in the military? For a first responder? For a hunter? For an outdoorsman? Or somebody that just likes cool military stuff? I've got the perfect gift for you, the Battle Mug. Starts as 10 pounds of aluminum, it's milled machine anodized, adorned with Picatinny rails, and then stamped with the serial number, and it's ready for you to make your own. Anything that went on your rifle or pistol can go on your mug, scope, laser, camera, light, put a lid on it, and you're ready for the field. If you're inside, add a flag and an emblem, and you're set. Perfect for any commemorative event. Farewell, promotion, retirement, birthday, anniversary, or get out of the doghouse. The Battle Mug is the perfect unique gift. Check out the entire line of product at BattleMug.com. Enter the promo code Marine for 15% off. Battle Mug is a veteran-owned and operated company. The product is made entirely in the United States. Check it out. BattleMug.com.
MilitaryByOwner.com is an excellent resource for any military family moving to a new area. We found a ton of homes to choose from and purchased a house 8 days later. This was the only site I used. Thanks, Military by Owner.
Are you PCSing? Do you need to find a home near a military base quickly? With over 45,000 listings and 15 years of experience helping military families find, sell, or rent their home near a military base, MilitaryByOwner.com can help. Military by Owner, proven and dependable.